Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A senior Palestinian official described the military offensive in the Syrian port city of Latakia as a crime against humanity. Turkey has joined a growing chorus of nations demanding an end to the Assad regime's crackdown on a five-month-old uprising. But instead, the Syrian government has escalated its offensive. Joining me in the studio to talk about the situation in Syria, Hisham Malham of Al Arabiya News Channel, Mona Yacoubian of the Center for Conflict Analysis Prevention at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Robert Malley at the International Crisis Group. We do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Do join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hisham Malham, what is, if you can put a word to it, what is the reasoning behind President Assad escalating the crackdown during Ramadan?
Both sides, the government as well as the opposition, saw Ramadan as almost a decisive month in terms of the qualitative pressure from the opposition against the regime. And the regime realizes that it is under tremendous regional as well as international pressure. And the escalated campaign now, which is covering major cities throughout the country, is seen as a desperate attempt to snuff out the uprising before the Turks and the Americans and others take tougher position against a regime that is losing its narrow base to begin with, and we're at a time when we're beginning to see cracks even within the military.
And joining us now to talk about one of the nations which has spoken out is the Turkish Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Selcuk Ünal. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning to all your listeners, ma'am.
Can you tell me what is Turkey's stance regarding Syria and President Assad's crackdown?
Well, from the very beginning, we have been advising the Syrian administration to implement reforms and to implement those reforms immediately and as soon as possible. These are, of course, political reforms, and we were also advising in strong terms that their people's quest for more transparency, accountability, and democracy should be heard and should be approached by peaceful means. But we understand that the Syrian administration is carrying on military assaults in response to those requests.
Indeed, Syria has actually escalated its crackdown since the foreign minister's visit, the Turkish foreign minister's visit to Syria. I understand that was a seven-hour meeting. What steps is Turkey actually prepared to take besides vocalizing its opposition?
Well, in that seven-hour-long meeting, we have asked them to pull the military units from the cities and from stop attacking the civilians. And also give free access to the international press. In the first day, they pulled from Hama, and the second day, they allowed our ambassador to visit Hama, and then also allowed Turkish international press to visit Hama. But then afterwards, we saw, unfortunately, that the escalation continued. Now, of course, we will be, yesterday, the Turkish foreign minister made a statement that unless the operations stop, the dialogue with the Syrian administration regarding the steps that they have promised us to take, EA reforms, would not mean anything. So that's where we are at the moment, and we will, of course, continue to monitor the situation very closely, and we will look up to the situation as the situation ongoing.
How many Syrians have taken refuge in Turkey since the protests began, and are you considering a buffer zone?
Since the protests began, there were a total of 15,000 Syrian nationals who have entered Turkey. By the time, almost half of them have returned on their own voluntary will. And at the moment, it's just below 7,000. On the other question, we didn't announce any buffer zone or of anything of that sort at the moment. So we will continue to monitor the situation. And if there will be other Syrian nationals coming over, of course, we will be welcoming them.
Turkish Foreign Ministry spokesman Selcuk Ünal, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And joining us now from Beirut, Lebanon, and is CNN correspondent Arwad Damon. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Tell me how you are getting your information out of Syria.
Well, it's incredibly challenging, especially since the Syrian government is not allowing us back into the country. So we do end up relying heavily on the images that we're receiving via various videos that are posted to YouTube, of course, bearing in mind that it is always with a caveat that we have absolutely no way of independently verifying these videos' authenticity. We do, however, try to pair up the story that appears to be unfolding in these YouTube videos with various narratives, accounts that we hear from activists, from residents that we're able to reach in various cities and towns inside the country itself. So it's very much trying to put together a patchwork of very different, oftentimes contradictory information, but really trying to weave it all together in a way that would seem to be the closest thing to what could be the reality of what is unfolding in Syria. But it is very much a situation that is clouded in quite a bit of mystery.
What are the videos showing us about what's going on in the port city of Latakia?
The most recent videos to emerge have, yes, been emerging out of Latakia, especially from the southern portion of the city, the Al-Ramel neighborhood that has really borne the brunt of this most recent military crackdown. And the videos have shown anything from a naval vessels that activists claim have been firing on these neighborhoods. That is, of course, an allegation that the government denies, to showing smoke rising, a lot of intense gunfire, explosions heard in it. And then there's also been the emergence of some incredibly disturbing videos, notably this one clip that shows a little girl. She's 2.5 years old, and she'd been shot. She's lying on the pavement. Her little white T-shirt is covered in blood. And activists were telling us, residents of that area were telling us, that she'd been trying to flee with her family following a call by the Syrian security forces telling residents to get out, and that was when their vehicle was fired on. Now, we don't know the exact circumstances of her death. We only have that one account to go by. But she most certainly does provide at least one of what have been many images of the ongoing innocent lives lost in this uprising.
Now, on the one hand, you say that Syrian officials are urging or telling people to flee. On the other hand, we understand there women and children are being herded into various stadiums and stripped of IDs and mobile phones.
You know, the story of this stadium is actually one that is proving to be quite chilling, especially when one tries to piece together what is happening there from outside the country. What activists are telling us is that a number of families, either as they were trying to flee or after they had fled, were herded into the stadium where their IDs were taken off of them, their mobile phones were taken off of them. There have been various reports as to what is actually happening inside that stadium. I think the most disturbing part of it is that the activists who we spoke to said that they were extremely worried. They were imagining horrific things taking place there because they were unable to get through to anyone who was actually in the stadium itself. That being said, we also have the case of the United Nations refugee agency raising an alarm bell as to the fate of Palestinians that were living inside a refugee camp in the same neighborhood. Thousands of them reported to have fled. Their fate, their whereabouts, currently unknown. And so for those looking at the situation from the outside, for the activists, the opposition members on the inside, it really paints an image that they say is absolutely hair-raising.
When one thinks about herding people into stadiums, you're absolutely right about the chilling effect that sends. Are they herding people out of the stadiums and into or out of the country, or are they simply holding them there?
We have heard conflicting reports about that. We heard from one organization that in some cases women and children were being allowed to leave. Men were being transferred to detention facilities. We heard from others that they were being kept confined inside the stadium itself. And what makes this especially hair-raising and chilling for the Syrian opposition is that they will tell you that they know full well the capabilities of this regime when it comes to complete and total merciless brutality. And so they will say that they fear the worst. The worst, of course, being that some sort of a mass execution is going to be taking place. Of course, there's absolutely no evidence that that is, in fact, the case, and the Syrian government continues to maintain that it is simply targeting these armed terrorist gangs, that its main aim is to try to protect and preserve the population. But when it comes to the opposition, when it comes to a lot of the global leaders, the international community that's peering into Syria, watching and listening to these conflicting and contradictory narratives, the government's version of events becomes increasingly difficult.
Arwa Damon of CNN, thank you so much. And welcome back here in the studio, Mona Yacoubian of the Center for Conflict Analysis Prevention at the U.S. Institute of Peace, Robert Malley of the International Crisis Group, Hisham Melham, he's Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya News Channel. And throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. One of the first emails we've received is from Tommy in Raleigh, North Carolina, who says, why hasn't President Obama done anything to stop the attacks on civilians in Syria? Yesterday, we heard Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta talk about the fact that they are stating day after day that this violence has got to stop, but they haven't gone so far, Mona, as to say Assad needs to go.
I think this is a very explicit decision by the Obama administration to not put itself in a position where it's unable to follow its words with action. And so they are seeking, I think, behind the scenes, multilateral support for action. Now, again, I think there's also the Libya syndrome, and it's very clear that there will not be military intervention in Syria. So I think the administration is weighing its words very, very carefully. And I think behind, rather than putting the emphasis on public statements, is focusing more behind the scenes.
What are the protesters demanding, Robert Malley?
I think at this point, and it may have been true from the beginning, but I think it's certainly true today, they're demanding the fall of the regime, the end of the Assad regime. And there's no doubt about that anymore. There was some talk at the beginning about reform. Mm-hmm. The kinds of reforms they were asking for probably were of the type that could not have been consistent with the survival of the regime. Mm-hmm. But today, given particularly what we've heard today, but even what we've been hearing now for months, there's no way that the people who are on the streets are going to accept to live in a country that is ruled by this by this family.
And Hisham Elham, what about Turkey's comments? Will they have any weight or import?
Of all the regional powers, Turkey has the most influence in Syria. In the last 10 years, Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey has invested a great deal of his time and effort and energy in helping Bashar al-Assad and in projecting Bashar al-Assad to the world and selling Bashar al-Assad to the Europeans and to the United States as, quote-unquote, a reformer and a potential peacemaker with the Israelis. Erdogan did mediate between the Israelis under Ehud Olmert and Bashar al-Assad. And according to the American sources, not the Turks, nor the Israelis or the Syrians, the Turks did a very good job, professional job. Erdogan invested financially. Erdogan's whole approach, or the, what we call in the Arab world now, the return of the new Ottomans to the Middle East, was through the Syrian gate. He signed economic treaties with Syria. In fact, there was in 2010 an economic agreement between among Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, and in Jordan. The Turks promulgated something called zero problem with the neighbors. That is, you know, we don't want any problems with all our neighbors. Now, that policy of zero problems with the neighbors is in tatters. Erdogan is a very stubborn man, is a very proud man, and he finds it very difficult to admit that all his investment in Bashar al-Assad has failed. But the Turks are doing a wonderful job in helping the Syrian refugees. And by the way, the Turks have a very good record in that, because they helped the refugees from Iraq in the past too. At this stage, the United States is still coordinating its approach to Syria with Turkey. And I think there was a time when the Americans were following the Turks. And I think Mona's point is well taken up to a certain point. The United States should not follow Turkey. The United States should coordinate with Turkey, but should also lead. But the Turks definitely, because of geography, because of history, because of politics, because of personal relationship with the Assad regime. In fact, the foreign ministry of Turkey, he himself said that he visited Syria 60 times in the last 8-9 years. So they have influence. And I think... But they've been saying these are barbaric tactics. We gave, you know, the Bashar administration many warnings. Now these warnings are ringing hollow. They have to act, otherwise they will really lose credibility.
Robert Malley, this morning we read in the newspapers that Syria is reaching out around the world to try to tamp down this dissident stance. In other words, it's not just using brutality within Syria, but reaching out to other parts of the world.
Well, certainly I think Syria is concerned about what has become this chorus of condemnation. At the same time, I think we have to be quite clear-eyed about the fact that international condemnation, pressure from outside, could have an impact, but only so far. This is a regime at this point that is fighting for its survival, and as we hear, will do everything to survive, even if it's at the cost of its alliances, even if it's at the cost of sanctions, even if it's at the cost of all its international relations. So yes, I think people would feel better if there was a more consistent international position. But let's not delude ourselves into thinking that that's going to have any impact on the behavior of the regime.
What about Syrian clerics, Mona? What role have they played?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, the traditional Sunni clerical establishment that's allied with the regime has largely towed the line. But we are getting early now new reports that there may actually be some divisions and that there are some who are now preaching in the mosques against this brutal repression that was so chillingly described by Arwa Damon. I think it's still early days, but it's very important to watch. Because if the Sunni clerical establishment begins to use the power in the mosque in places like Damascus and Aleppo, which have yet to see massive demonstrations, if they use that to mobilize, that could really be an important tipping point.
What about the possibility of sectarian violence?
This is the most worrisome factor here. The longer this confrontation continues between the regime and the opposition, two things we can talk about with certainty: that it will be more violent, and that ugly sectarianism will rear its head. We've seen this in the past. In fact, from 1978 till 1982, there was a low intensity civil strife in Syria, which culminated in the horrendous bloodletting orgy of violence in Hama, where at least 10,000 people were killed in the span of 2 or 3 weeks, when heavy artillery was used against whole neighborhoods in Hama. Hence the symbolic significance of Hama and why the American ambassador Robert Ford visited Hama a few weeks ago. Sectarianism is a factor, and I think it is very crucial for the United States, for the international community, for the Turks, for the Arab states, as well as the opposition, to make it clear, to speak out against sectarianism, to say we will never tolerate any communal retribution or revenge or settling of scores. Because one of the reasons sectarianism is ugly now is that the regime is trying to play the sectarian card. The regime is trying to assure or tell or scare the minorities in Syria. And keep in mind, Syria is a human mosaic. Yes, the majority are Arabs and Muslims, but there are significant non-Arab minorities like the Kurds, and there are significant religious minorities like the more than 2 million Christians in Syria. Then you have the Druze and the Ismailis, not to mention the Alawis, who are almost 12% of the population. So the regime is scaring the Alawis, of course, its base, and the Druze, and particularly the Christians. And one of the reasons you don't have mass demonstrations in Aleppo and Damascus is where you have the Sunni establishment, the merchant class, which benefited in the past from the regime, because they said, we will not get involved in politics if you allow us to involve only in the economic domain. And because you have presence of the Christian minority in those two cities. So the Christians watch Iraq, and they see what happened to the Christian community in Iraq, the revenge and the killings, burning of churches. They watch Egypt with trepidation, because also you have a strong 10, 11 million Copts in Egypt, and yet they cannot even protect their property and their lives and their churches. And I think, people should keep that in mind. This is the most worrisome thing, that is, the threat of sectarianism.
When the opposition speaks out, are they asking for foreign military intervention, Robert Malley?
No, they're not, and I think they're wise not to, because foreign intervention in the region has a very bad name, and you only have to look at the case of Iraq to understand that. I want to come back to Hisham's point, which I think is absolutely critical. What's keeping the regime today still in place, one of the key things that's keeping it in place, is that many Syrians fear the alternative. They fear the unknown. They fear chaos. They fear sectarian strife. They fear the witch hunt, as happened in Iraq against all the former Ba'athists. There are many former Ba'athists, current Ba'athists in Syria. So the real challenge for the opposition and for others in the world is to reassure those who today don't like the regime. It's hard really to like what it's doing, but are extremely worried by what might come next. Mm. And the things that the U.S. and others could do most effectively is not so much sanctions, but is to try to put together the form of reassurance in terms of what the political future, the economic future, the sectarian future of Syria will be. They look at the region, as Hisham say, there's not much reason for optimism. If you look at Lebanon, if you look at Iraq, even if you look at Egypt today, those are not reasons for hoping that the future is going to be as bright as one would like it to be.
Mona, is there any economic pressure that the world community could put on Syria that would bring at least a pause, an end to this violence?
I don't know about an end to the violence, but there's been increasing talk about the need for sanctions on Syria's oil and gas. This is a very important part of the Syrian economy. It accounts for maybe 25% to 35% of Syria's GDP. It's an important source of revenue for the regime. And we are seeing that there's increasing talk, particularly in Europe, of perhaps freezing the assets of the Syrian oil company. 95% of Syria's oil and gas exports go to Europe. So this could, in fact, make a significant dent or at least add to pressure. Again, I don't think in the short term it's going to change things, but I really think we're talking now about a medium-term proposition of pressuring this regime and isolating it diplomatically.
Rob, you're not in favor.
No, I'm a skeptic when it comes to sanctions in general. I think targeted sanctions that look at individuals who've been engaged in repression, who've been engaged in corruption, send a signal that we know what you're doing, and if anyone else does that, we'll target you as well. But the kind of general sanctions that people are talking about are going to hurt society more than they're going to hurt the regime. Just look, even in the region, every case where there's been sanctions, the regimes have found ways to circumvent them. The people have suffered. It's going to weaken the society that we now want to strengthen. It's going to weaken Syria for the future, and it's going to be much harder to rebuild Syria. And it's going to give an argument, however marginally effective it will be, for the regime to see. You see, it's the West that's trying to bring Syria down back on its knees. We need to stand together against this plot. I think there are better things to do.
I gather you and Rob have differing views on this.
I would differ a bit on that. I do think it's important. I think Rob's points are well taken. But I actually think, first, given the corruption in Syria, it's not as though the society has really benefited directly from these oil and gas revenues. Also, more importantly, I think the very desperate situation the country finds itself in is one in which we've heard opposition leaders both inside Syria and outside calling for these sanctions and saying the Syrian people are willing to undertake that sacrifice in the name of putting an end to this regime.
Mona Yacoubian of the U.S. Institute of Peace, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about the military? Do they speak with one voice, Hisham?
The Syrian military, unfortunately, does not have the traditions of the Egyptian military or the Tunisian military. That is, not been used against the people. The Syrian military has a lousy history of oppression against the Syrian people. Arab militaries in general have done the dirty job of their regimes. They've done it in Iraq under Saddam. They've done it in Yemen. They've done it in Algeria. They've done it in Sudan. They've done it in Jordan, everywhere. The Egyptian case and the Tunisian case are somewhat different. So you don't have a professional Syrian military that could do to Assad what the Egyptian military and the Tunisian military did to Ben Ali in Tunisia and Mubarak in Egypt. In essence, it's the Egyptian military and the Tunisian military that pushed the dictator out, ran him out of Dodge. This is not going to happen in Syria. What is likely to happen is the breakdown of the military, is a defection, an implosion. There are units, major units that are controlled by Alawi officers. The Alawites are the minority that President Assad and all the Syrian officials belong to. These are the tip of the spear. And one of them is led by Maher al-Assad, who is a thug, who happens to be the brother of Bashar al-Assad. History repeats itself in many ugly ways. In 1982, it was the enforcer of Hafez al-Assad, his name was Rifat al-Assad, who's his brother, who destroyed Hama. Today, the enforcer for Bashar al-Assad is his younger brother, Maher al-Assad.
Mona.
You know, I would largely agree with Hisham, although I do think the recent replacement of the Minister of Defense, who was an Alawite and who was then later found dead in his apartment, could...
No, he was not dead. He was not dead.
Okay, that was the initial news reporting.
No, not that. He actually appeared on Syrian television.
Okay, well, nonetheless, his replacement could potentially signal that there is some disaffection even among senior Alawite generals. And again, I would largely agree with Hisham, but it's something worth watching over time. As the repressive tactics that the regime uses become increasingly egregious, does this, in fact, provoke some deeper dissension within the military? And are there divisions between the very narrowly defined circle of the regime and senior Alawite officers in the army?
It would seem that that would be the only hope for ending this terrible siege.
I mean, it's one of the paradoxes of minority regimes or minority-controlled regimes that they often are overthrown by their own minorities.
Yeah.
The majority, we know that they're against them, but the minority has developed the security apparatus. The question here is whether there'll be enough Alawites in high level security levels, who are going to say, are we sacrificing our future for the benefit not of our community, but of two, three families, or one family that has tried to monopolize both economic and political assets? That's the question. And I think Alawites at some point may say, we don't want to put our entire community in jeopardy because of these people. We're going to go back to our villages, seek protection there, and let Assad and his people fend for themselves.
How important do you believe it would be for President Obama to call for Assad to step down?
I don't think it's critical. I think what Secretary Clinton said yesterday was accurate when she said, so if President Obama says it, then what? It's not as if people are going to be surprised. I think the message is pretty clear. I think the other thing she said, which is true, is if it were a coordinated statement by President Obama, Prime Minister Erdogan, other Arab leaders, European leaders, then it takes a greater significance. There's more clarity. But as I said earlier, this is a story that's going to unfold in Syria as a result of Syrian actions, not of foreigners.
Robert Malley of the International Crisis Group. When we come back, we'll open the phones for your questions, comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org, and by John and Catherine Debs, committed to advancing understanding of the issues involved in America's energy future. This is NPR.
Many of us know the joy of owning a puppy, but bringing home an older dog can be just as fulfilling. An animal behaviorist on the challenges of adopting an adult dog. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Omar in Portland, Oregon. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a comment and a question. Why you cover in Syria and Libya, but you don't cover Bahrain when Bahrain invaded by Saudi Army and United Arab Emirates, and they have mercenaries from Syria, back, Iraq, Yemen, Jordan, Pakistan, and they've been killing people in Bahrain. About 5,000, they've been fired from job by the government. They have over 1,000 person in jail, tortured by the government, and some people died in the jail from torture, and men and women and children being killed, the youngest like 6 months, and the oldest about 15 years old.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Robert Malley.
Well, I mean, I think there is an issue here, not so much about your show. I think what's happening in Syria certainly is deserving of a full hour. But, you know, you have countries like Bahrain that are now condemning the repression in Syria, which takes a little bit of gall given what's happened in Bahrain. And you have countries like Iran that are condemning what's happening in Bahrain. So there is, each country is looking at its own interests, and each one is looking at it through its own prism.
One question that keeps coming up, who's paying for this? Where is the money coming from? Some people have speculated Iran is offering funds to Assad. Is that how you see it, Mona?
You know, it's hard to know. I think that that information, that certainly there's been speculation, but frankly, the status of Syrian finances is opaque, to say the least. That's, again, I think, where questions that relate to attempting to strangle the economy somewhat, the oil and gas in particular, I think become relevant again. There is some question as to how long Syria's foreign exchange reserves will last. And again, I think no one really knows for sure what it is that's financing.
Absolutely correct. The Iranians are helping the Syrians. If the Syrian regime falls, Iran will be dealt a serious strategic setback. Syria is the only major Arab country that supported Iran, and the Syrian-Iranian relationship from the days of Khomeini and Hafez Assad from 1979 has been extremely solid, and it's very important. That's why a change in regime in Damascus, and if you have a much better representative regime in Damascus, the whole region will change. And in fact, the Syrian uprising will be more important than the Egyptian uprising, because it will have reverberations throughout the Eastern Mediterranean.
What about Bahrain? And what about our caller's comments that thousands are in prison, that the regime there is equally bad as that of Syria?
The regime is bad. I'm not sure it's equally bad like Syria. Even in despotism, there is a hierarchy. Even in despotism, there is a hierarchy. Saddam Hussein occupied a special place. This fellow in Damascus occupied a special place. Libya, the same thing. Bin Ali did not do the massacres that Saddam did. So, I mean, you know, they're all autocrats. They are all autocrats. They are all, or many of them are despots, but there is a difference. In Bahrain, you have less than 50 people who were killed. It's awful. This is a regime that is systematically discriminate against the majority Shia of the country. You have 30%, and the caller is correct. They are hiring mercenaries from faraway Pakistan just because they are Sunnis, to use them to crack down on the majority Shia population that are asking peacefully for their full rights as citizens. And so when we talk about Syria, it doesn't mean that you are excusing the brutality of Bahrain or of other states. I start from the premise that all Arab regimes are autocratic, but some of them are worse, and some of them are truly despotic.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Rachel. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I was wondering, Are there any actual Christians that have joined the protests there? Or is it as quote sectarian as it's been called?
Right. I mean, there certainly are Christians that have joined the protests, but at the same time, the Christian community is both divided and anxious and worried, again, for the reasons we mentioned earlier. They're a minority. They look at what's happening in the region where Christians are suffering. You know, that's one of the less covered stories of the last several years, is how the Christian communities in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Iraq, and elsewhere have really suffered. So the Christian community has been one of the constituencies on which the regime has been counting on to remain in power, even as a number of intellectuals and others in the Christian community are joining the protests.
Here's True. An email from North Dallas. Ellis wants to know, would Bashar Assad provoke a war or incident with Israel to take the heat off and unite the country behind him?
It is too late. Everybody will see that as a transparent act. His army cannot even move. I mean, the Syrian army is having serious logistical problem moving from one area to another. Syria is not the size of Egypt, obviously, but it's not a tiny country. So here we have the Syrian army moving units from Deir ez-Zor in the east to Latakia in the west, to Deraa in the south, to Jisr al-Shuur in the north. It's a tough act. But the regime did try to explode the Palestinian issue during the commemoration of the division of Palestine, partition of Palestine. They sent demonstrators, they bussed them to the Golan, and they created an incident in which the Israelis, who are usually trigger happy, shot and killed a number of them. This is an awful regime that is not.
Get some backfire on that phrase, trigger happy, Hisham. what's your opinion, Rob?
I think Hisham is right when it comes to Syria. What I wonder about, and I've been wondering for some time, is Given how important Syria is not just to Iran but to Hezbollah, the Lebanese group, might you see at some point when they fear that the regime is about to fall, that they might try to do something, because so much is at stake in terms of the strategic balance in the country? I'm not sure what that would be. I think it would be extremely risky for Hezbollah because it would be the brunt of very massive retaliation by Israel. But if it sees that everything is at stake, everything is at play, the Syrians are known for playing different cards.
You never know.
You never know.
All right. To a caller here in Washington, D.C., good morning, Leah.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question and a comment, both. And I first asked my comment, and then I talked about my comment and then my question. My comment is that with all the good attention and that you all have, how would you strategically can prevent Israeli's intervention? Like what happened, according to Seymour Hersh, from the very beginning after Saddam Hussein, the government was toppled, Israelis start training commandos in the Kurdish area, and those commandos were the ones who started the sectarian wars by exploding the mosques in both sides, and they initiated the sectarian wars. And nobody is talking in the media, but Seymour Hersh had documented this, and we all know that Seymour Hersh is a wonderful Jewish reporter, so he couldn't be lying about this. And this sectarian war...
But he could exaggerate, as usual.
Please let me finish. This sectarian war destroyed so many Iraqi people. At the same time, all these lands in Iraq are purchased by Israelis. And now,
hold on now. Leah, we're really not talking about Iraq. And we're not talking about Israel this morning. We are talking about the violence in Syria. Perhaps you can save your comment to a program when we are discussing what's happening between Israel and its neighbors.
You know, if I can say something, Diane, this is really, they are playing into the hands of these regimes. Every problem in the Arab world with these regimes, they always accuse the Israelis and the Zionists and then the Americans. Every problem. This is what they have been doing forever. That's what the Syrian regime has done. That's what other Arab regimes have done. Every problem, whether it's from the Iraq to southern Sudan, the Israelis and the Zionists, and behind them, of course, the Americans are responsible for it. Nobody wants to take responsibility. These are, as Rob and I and everybody was saying, what is happening in Syria is a Syrian drama in which the actors are the Syrian people, and they are going to determine this. This regime exploited the conflict with Israel, and in the name of struggling against the Israelis and the Zionists, you know, they've been struggling against their own people and repressing their own people.
And that's this question from Thatcher, who wants to know what percentage of the Syrian population supports the Assad regime, Mona.
I think that's very, very difficult to say. I mean, it's clear, as I said earlier, that the two major cities in Syria, Damascus and Aleppo, have not seen widespread demonstrations that we've seen in places like Hama and Deir Zor. We've also talked about the minority populations who are very much, I think, in a difficult spot with respect to what the future might hold in a post-Assad Syria. We also have seen the Sunni business elite remain somewhat on the fence. And so all of this points to the fact that there's still, I don't know if I'd say significant, but there is a proportion of the Syrian population that is either on the fence or actively supporting the regime.
On the fence or actively supporting. All right, on that note, to Augustine in Fort Worth, Texas, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
I noticed that this is a position where Lebanon is going to have a very prominent place in the international arena, you know, the opportunity to be on the driving seat of the Security Council. Also, Turkey, since they didn't allow the United States to land when we were in Iraq, I think it's a good example of a democracy that happens to be Muslim. And if they have to implement a regional solution, you know, where Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, Jordan is pretty pro-Occidental, and control Iran's influence by just setting some basic boundaries, you know, to that regime, then they can negotiate a peaceful exit for the Assad family to be seeking a comfortable retirement in, I don't know, in Turkey or in Iran even, and assurance that there's not going to be prosecution, and then make a transition project where the region itself comes up with the guidelines, and that would pacify people and allow them to find their own way of government, because in my opinion, each and every one of those nations, unless they do something negotiated, you're going to wind up in a civil war, just like Iran, just like Afghanistan, now Syria, and maybe even Egypt and Tunisia. But
all right, sir. Thanks for calling. Mona.
Well, I think the caller is probably referring to the fact that Lebanon will assume the presidency of the UN Security Council in September. But Lebanon has really had a very difficult time in playing a key role in Syria. It is Syria's much smaller next-door neighbor, has lived in the shadow of and under Syrian hegemony for a period of 30 years. So the Lebanese, I think, are not well placed to play any sort of role in any kind of negotiation. But I guess I would disagree even with the contention. I just unfortunately don't see the possibility for a negotiated exit for the Assad family. Unfortunately, I think they are involved in a fight to the death.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Hisham, how is the instability in Syria affecting Hamas?
Oh, Hamas has found itself in a very awkward position yesterday and the day before when the Syrians were attacking the Palestinian refugee camp in Latakia, when the spokesperson for Hamas said, "We are not aware of such attack." At the same time, the Palestinian Authority was denouncing the Syrian regime. Hamas would lose if Bashar al-Assad goes. And that's why a political change in Damascus will have repercussions throughout the region, because it will affect Hezbollah standing in Lebanon. It will deal Iran a major strategic setback. Iran today, for all intents and purposes, has become a Mediterranean power for the first time since the Greek-Persian Wars. Thermopylae, remember those battles? So because of its influence in Syria, because of its sponsorship of Hezbollah in Lebanon, it's because of support for Hamas. If the regime changes in Damascus, you will have a completely redrawn political map in the Eastern Mediterranean.
And final question to all of you. Do you expect Assad to hang on? And if so, for how long?
To hang or to be hanged?
On.
I think it's very hard to see how this regime continues to rule, given where we are today. That said, and you know, it's lost its base of support domestically and internationally. Its last card is violence, and that's a card you could only use for so long. On the other hand, if you look at what's happening to the Arab Spring, if that's what we want to call it, since Egypt and Tunisia, there's not a single case where a regime has fallen. The case that is closest is Libya, because we have NATO intervention. I think rulers have learned one lesson. You don't give up. You fight till the end, because you start showing any weakness and you're gone. And that's why this tragedy may continue for longer than objective conditions would seem to suggest.
Mona.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think essentially, you know, the regime could hang on for the short to medium term, but its longevity, I think, is not at all assured. My own sense is that the two sort of key cornerstones that buttress this regime and its hold on power, fear at home and geostrategic significance in the region, both of those have been fatally damaged. And so I think in the long term, I think we will likely see the end of this regime.
Diane, dictators like Bashar al-Assad and Gaddafi and Ali Abdullah Saleh, all of these people, they have no retirement plans. The only transition they believe in is the transition from the presidential palace to the cemetery as leaders, dying as leaders. This is the regime will fight till the end. And remember what Gaddafi said, we will fight to the last man, to the last bullet. And I think Bashar will do the same. And that's the unfortunate reality. There is no way you can negotiate with this regime. In Egypt, at least, the president said, I'm not going to run again. In Tunisia, the president said, this is my last term. If Assad was asked before, as Rob was saying, when they began calling for reform, Assad was not going to say, this is my last term. And so this is an existential war between a regime against his own people. And he can prolong his rule. He can turn Syria into the North Korea of the Levant. But in the end, he will be overthrown and the end will be violent.
Hisham Elam, he's Washington bureau chief for Al Arabiya News Channel. Mona Yacoubian of the U.S. Institute of Peace. Robert Malley of the International Crisis Group. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.